The Defiant sensors registered a powerful explosion in the vicinity of the gateway. I trust your mission was a success?
The gateway's been destroyed, if that's what you mean.
Well done, Captain. You've all done quite nicely. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to inspect the wreckage.
That was for questioning our loyalty.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, not eating, not sleeping, not having sex.
Wow. Now that is an intro. And why did he say that, folks? Because this week we are going to talk about...
Because I'm a sad, sad man.
We're going to talk about The Evolution of the Dominion, which sounds like the title of a Cradle of Filth album.
Yeah. Notably, they do establish that the Jem'Hadar, they don't sleep, they don't eat, and they don't have sex. A little bit later on.
Make your excuses
I need to make my excuse now before a lot of people are like, okay, a little TMI there, Mr. Orton.
I like to think someone pressed stop right after you said that. Like, that's my takeaway from that episode.
Yeah. But look, we've kind of done these evolution of certain alien cultures before, and I think you and I have finally tapped into kind of the right formula to tackle these, which could otherwise be... just unwieldy.
Yeah.
But essentially, we go and find the most monumental episodes that really deliver kind of the big incremental changes of our understanding of these cultures. And so we're going to go in chronological order in Deep Space Nine, not from, you know, episode one, but, you know,
episode one, exterior.
Yeah. But we're going to tackle it and just see how the Dominion changes and how our understanding of them changes and, you know, what makes them so compelling as antagonists. I mean, I think you and I are both coming into this thinking of them as among the most compelling antagonists that Star Trek's ever had.
For sure. I mean, just the name Dominion.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a better name for an enemy force? It's so great.
I'll tell you what. I was growing up in the U.S. when I was watching Deep Space Nine, right? And they established, you know, it's the Dominion. And then I wasn't really getting that much Canadian education in my American schooling, unfortunately. So I had to do my own, like, Canadian history lessons on my own. This is the peril of a Canadian growing up in the United States. And when I found out the original name for Canada, like, was the Dominion of Canada, mm-hmm. I was like, it's the Dominion of Canada. Like, I thought that was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
So maybe a shout out to one of our all-time favorite guests, Doc Boris,
who's been
on the show. And he's all about the cool Canadian history. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that later on as well.
Yeah, for sure. Dominion is a word to me that sounds inherently evil. Like, just when you say the word Dominion, I picture, like, Hellraiser movies.
Okay.
You know, it just has that sound of something you would hear and that sort of thing. I mean, Paul Schrader named his Exorcist prequel Dominion.
Yeah.
So it's just, like, there's something about it that sounds very sinister.
It has
the word,
like, dominate in it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, so let's jump into it. First of all, look, we've had rumblings of the Dominion, I think, you know, throughout the first few seasons of Deep Space Nine. I think the first official name drop that we ever heard was from the Negus, in which they wanted to open up trade negotiations on...
It was Rules of Acquisition.
I apologize. Yeah, Rules of Acquisition. They wanted to open up trade negotiations on the Gamma Quadrant. But the actual first sighting that we had of anybody beyond... We can assume that the Tosk and the Hunter were all part of the Dominion, but the real introduction here is the Jem'Hadar, the season two finale, where Jake and Sisko go on a camping trip with Nog and Cork, which is...
Not the episode you expect to introduce the most evil villain in DS9.
It was kind of slow moving for the first, I'd say two-thirds.
It's like Cork making complaints about being in the wilderness.
And getting ointment rubbed on his lobes by his nephew.
What a setup.
Yeah. But look, the introduction of them is like we see these soldiers decloaking, which very reminiscent of what we saw Tosk doing. So you're like, oh, I see that there is kind of like this thread between these genetically bred, you know, soldier species.
It also feels somewhat influenced by the Predator. alien.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Of course, you know. And so this is where we're kind of introduced to kind of maybe, say, the look of the Jem'Hadar, where they're almost kind of rhino-like. They're eschewing...
I never thought of that, actually. It makes perfect sense. As soon as you said that, I was like, yeah, they do.
They've got the skin, the horns as well.
They look
kind of
rocky to me. I always thought of them as... Not the Sylvester Stallone character. This isn't a Creed 2 tie-in. No, like... just like
Bullwinkle's friend,
like their skin texture looks kind of like rock to me. It looks very solid, like almost like Korg in Thor Ragnarok. It's that similar kind of look to me.
Yeah,
but obviously, you know, it's just like a hard, tough hide, which is very rhino-like. Yeah.
Well, and so maybe let's break it down with just kind of the look. We know that they can decloak. We know that they're hooked onto the Ketracel White. When you're introduced to them, like, what did you think of kind of maybe the look of the Jem'Hadar here?
I really thought they were cool right off the bat. And, you know, Berman-era Star Trek shows, a lot of the time when they would introduce new aliens, I can't say I was that wowed. Some of them had more effort than others. Some of them looked really cool. But they rarely, I feel like, hit that iconic bar that so many of the original series aliens did in their designs.
Not like Quark's bar.
Bar association.
Yeah.
Yes. But I felt like the Jem'Hadar instantly worked as an adversary. Like, they had that fearsome, iconic look you want right out of the gate, where they're instantly identifiable as a threat, and you can totally picture them in your head when the episode's over. Like, a lot of the aliens on Berman-era Trek, some of them really grow on me over time, but it takes a while before I can instantly conjure them up in my head.
Like the Mick Fleetwood alien from season one of
those
TNG.
Work, man. Those are iconic.
How come they haven't come back?
I don't know. That was lost opportunity to not bring those back.
Stevie Nicks didn't want to be on screen with Mick Fleetwood. That's why. Yeah. Oh, that band has so much history.
But I'm fascinated to know from you, because you were watching it in the era. Did you watch? I know you hadn't caught up yet, were you?
Well, no, I was watching Deep Space Nine here or there.
Yeah, yeah.
I was still more into Next Gen at this time, and because Next Gen was in season 7. At this point, so I actually missed the introduction of the Dominion or the Jem'Hadar here. It wasn't until the following episode, which we'll discuss in just a minute with Search parts 1 and 2, that I was like, oh, I get it. This is kind of a cool, badass sort of alien species going forward. The other alien species that we're introduced to, though, is the Vorta.
Yeah.
And it has telepathic powers at this point.
Yeah.
That never come up again.
Yeah, it's his character, Eris, who is maybe the only telepathic Vorta around.
Or maybe it was just kind of like a parlor trick. Maybe like that's how I've kind of justified it in my own brain.
Right, like, yeah, maybe it's like just what she does at parties.
Yeah, you know. Sure. So, or just kind of smoke and mirrors on the part of, like, this whole Dominion trap that they're setting for Sisko and company.
Sure, the whole thing is a ruse, essentially, to learn about the Federation and Starfleet, so you could easily walk away being like, well, you know, I'm sure the writers could easily retcon all that and be like, no, that was just part of the ruse.
So what do you think of kind of the betrayal of the Vorta here, in which we do get a bit of that hints of the wiliness to come from other Vorta that we meet throughout the rest of the series?
I think what they really set up in this episode right away is that the Vortas are really charismatic aliens.
Yeah.
In terms of watching them on screen, they're magnetic. And I think one of the geniuses of the show was always casting just perfect actors to play these Vorta. Do you feel like, you know, a lot of it, Star Trek loves to recycle actors for various alien species. Do you think there's a certain skill set that is required to play a really good Vorta versus some of the others?
Like, okay, so diminutive.
Sure.
Number one.
Yeah. But in terms of, like, I don't know, like, just charisma.
I think it's in the eyes. I think there has to be something in the eyes that says it's simultaneously welcoming and then repulsive.
Yeah.
You know, and like they, you kind of feel as if you're talking to a snake oil salesman who you actually really want to hang out with.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. But there are moments, and we'll dive into it deeper with Wei Yun as well, but there are moments where, like, okay, I get where Wei Yun's coming from. I understand. And I think maybe he does have my best interest because it's in his best interest too.
Right. And I think part of the interesting element of them for me is that they have almost like a woodlands pixie kind of look.
Oh, yeah.
Or fairy look, or even like elf. And so you don't necessarily look at them as dangerous. They look kind of fun in a certain way. But I like that they have that slight twist on them, and that they are very threatening. And that's, to me, kind of the dichotomy of, you know, between what they look like and actually how they are within the show that makes them really interesting. You look at a Jem'Hadar, you know they're trouble the second you see them.
Mm.
Whereas the Vorta, you could easily be duped by them.
Yeah.
And I like that element of them. You know, one is manipulative and crafty, whereas the other is just a blunt force instrument.
And I think that's kind of what makes the Dominion the Dominion. Like,
sure.
They come in with the welcoming arms of the Vorta, if that doesn't work, if diplomacy doesn't work, then you'll just get crushed by the Jem'Hadar after that. What do you make of the Dominion's plan, or I guess the Founder's plan here, to kind of learn as much as they can about the Federation and what exactly the Federation has in mind for the future of the Gamma Quadrant?
I mean, it makes sense to size up a potential enemy before you strike. And do you think at this point they knew they were going to go after the Starfleet and the Federation? Or do you think it's more like we have to determine how big a threat they are before we determine how we want to proceed?
So from what I understand, yes, they did know that. But the thing is, they were well aware of the Federation, but they did not have plans in place to deal with them for another 200 to 300 years.
Right. Yeah, because they think long term. That's something that's very interesting about the Dominion is they don't think about today. They think hundreds of years from now.
Yes. Well, and it's also established that they've been around for 2,000 years.
Yeah, although that number changes depending on the episode. At one point, they say 10,000 years.
You know.
But I like that, you know, the Wayuuns are very inconsistent in the numbers they give.
Well, they have been cloned many times, so that, you know, you kind of, it's like a copy of a copy.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of fades away like that. But with regards to kind of the plans for the Federation, I mean, that was all thrown out of whack because of the introduction of the wormhole. Mm-hmm. So they had to reevaluate how they're going to handle the Federation here. What do you make of maybe the Federation's initial response when we find out that the Dominion's like, hey, look, guys, you're kind of encroaching on our territory here. We don't want you coming in to explore. We don't want you coming in to try to do trade deals. Mm-hmm. And the Federation's response is, screw you. Like, is it like, does the Dominion have a point to a certain degree?
You know, the Starfleet is all about respecting other cultures.
Do they respect the Dominion? The Dominion says, you're in our territory. Don't do this anymore.
I know.
And they say, like, don't go through the wormhole anymore. It's not cool.
Yeah.
And they constantly go through the wormhole and chart and meet new species. And
is this maybe a Star Trek issue, though? Not just, working with the Dominion, but, you know, you look at, say, the Borg on Voyager, things like that, where they go through these areas that are overseen by these huge, gigantic forces. They tend to want to mess with them a lot, as opposed to respecting their, domination over the territory.
See, I can not abide by the methods the Dominion uses,
sure,
but I can understand their motivation by wanting to push back against Federation. I would call it Federation aggression to a certain degree. They were not honoring, what the Dominion territory is here. And I think as we wrap up our discussion on the Jem'Hadar and take this further on, though, like I think this is a kind of a very chilling episode in a certain degree. And like this is coming the week that All Good Things airs.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the end of our adventures on a galaxy class starship. And this one concludes with the Dominion doing kamikaze flight jumps into a galaxy class starship here. Which is the USS Odyssey is destroyed, and they are trying to make us very fearful of what the Jem'Hadar are willing to do in order to secure their territory and push back against any sort of what they perceive as aggression.
It definitely works as an attention grabbing, like, look out, these guys are a threat that you haven't really seen on Star Trek. It tends to be the villains that they deal with are much more cerebral.
Yeah.
Or the Borg, it's like an unstoppable force, obviously, but it's also driven by a certain logic. Like, kamikaze missions into ships is something that we are not used to dealing with, and not the sort of thing that a captain can talk them out of.
Right.
Whereas even with the Borg, you see Starfleet trying to communicate with them and trying to talk some sense in them. You can't really do that with the Jem'Hadar. And that's interesting, especially with a captain like Sisko, who is obviously a pretty rough customer himself.
Yeah. Just one last note here, though. Eris doesn't actually recognize Odo as a founder, which is very interesting. And honestly, I 100% understand it. Like, why would the founders be looking like Odo on their side of the wormhole?
Right.
There's no reason for them to don this appearance as they would in later seasons. So,
right.
Why don't we jump over to Search Parts 1 and 2, in which we have the introduction of the Defiant, which is notable because this is kind of the warship that they need to have to go up against the Dominion. The writers were like, yeah, we realized we couldn't have big shuttles as kind of our, pushback against the Dominion.
Yeah.
So if we have an aggressive culture on the other side of the wormhole, let's be the aggressors even more and get a warship on our side, equip it with a cloaking device, and go let's go search out their home world and fly our warship to their home world.
Doesn't that seem like a pretty ballsy thing for a Star Trek captain to do.
Cam, I kind of lean more and more towards like the Federation being the cause of this war with the Dominion.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yes, a very ballsy thing. And look, this two-parter is notable in that we establish the fact that, well, in fact, the founders that were talked about a lot about in the Jem'Hadar, well, they're the changelings. They're Odo species here. Was this something that you kind of knew was approaching? Like,
I don't think so. No, when I first saw the search, I don't recall thinking that would be the case.
Yeah,
I don't know that I really had a good sense of what the Dominion were.
So
it was kind of like when it's revealed, you're like, oh, okay, now I see where this show is going.
Yeah.
Versus before, it's like, I'd seen Vorta, I'd seen Jem'Hadar, but I'm like, I really don't know how these things are going to work later down the road.
And maybe like the word founders didn't really register with you that much. But to me, it kind of answered the question, one of the mysteries of the show is like, what is the origin of Odo here? And that was, I think, like emphasized a lot more in season one.
Big time.
I think, was it the episode Vortex where they had that guy who claimed that he could show Odo his, you know, past or whatever.
Isn't like half that episode on like a cave set?
And the other half was in a runabout.
Yeah, it's not a good episode.
It's not a good episode. Yeah. But I think this is actually really boosting kind of the mythology as we understand it with regards to the Dominion. And that they're, again, testing the Federation here. They put them through those kind of chambers that make them have that dream that they're interacting with, you know, which is kind of interesting. They want to test the response of like Dominion aggression in the Alpha Quadrant. So they put our main cast to sleep, which has happened in, say, bad episodes of Deep Space Nine that I've been forced to watch. You know, I'm looking at you, Progress.
Oh, Progress.
Yeah. But as kind of a mission statement, is Jem'Hadar and Search Parts 1 and 2 just kind of a really strong 1-2 punch of how to establish, like, this antagonist and know that they mean business and they're not going to be kind of a lame antagonist going forward?
Oh, I think so very much. And there's something I think really interesting about having... You know, Odo is a character I think it's very easy for the audience to have a lot of affection for in that kind of puppy dog way. He's this character who doesn't know who he is. We want to see him find where he came from. And then he finds it, and we get the female changeling showing up for the first time, who's going to be a very vital character coming down the road. And, you know, she says, "Welcome home." And then next thing we know, you know, Odo's warning them against messing with the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah.
And it's like such a twist on what you would ever expect for the episode where Odo finds his home. That it's like, oh my god, like this isn't good at all.
They're the evil aggressors,
yeah.
As the audience is at least led to believe.
What was your first take on the female changeling when she first showed up?
I had no idea that she was going to be such a big part of the mythology for the next 5 seasons.
Yeah.
I actually thought it was kind of an interesting take on it. It never really registered to me that they were really just kind of mimicking Odo's look, you mm-hmm. know? I was just like, yeah, that's what they must all look like. And so for me, it actually, we first get hints here that, okay, well, they can, you know, take on like forms of, you know, other species at a much better, you know, complex way than, say, Odo can.
Right.
And I think that's planting seeds for what we'd see in later seasons. But my first...
Like a bird.
Yeah, thank you. Is that a home front chatter?
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. But look, I think with regards to, like, say, Salome Jens and her performance as the changeling, she's doing something very interesting here where she's kind of...
Underplaying it.
Yes.
Big time.
Which I think makes a lot of sense where you're going to take this particular antagonist who, by the time we get to the final episode, she's literally ordering the genocide of Cardassia.
Yeah.
And I think it's very smart of, and I don't know how much she foresaw what was going to come with the character, but I think the way that she approached this was very smart.
Well, when you think, too, just later down the road, and again, who knows how cognizant any of the writers were about where the show was going to go, but... You have characters like, you know, Mark Alaimo's Gul Dukat, who's played very big. He's a very big character. Jeffrey Combs' Wayun, fairly big personality, mm-hmm. you know, definitely a broad character. Whereas her being much more, you know, underplayed makes a really interesting contrast when you throw her in these situations where she's surrounded by these kind of outsized villains. And she's the one who's kind of the gravity in the center holding them all together. That's what's really interesting is that she's not the big charisma bomb character, but she's the one that's you know, the most dangerous.
But I think she plays off Odo so well, and I wonder if she's looking at a lot of what Rene Auberjonois was doing with his own performance and seeing, okay, so this is kind of the species that he comes from. What can I do to kind of bounce off of him and make sure that there's, like, actually, like, kinetic energy between these characters so that it's not just, like, a super kind of, like, snooze fest?
Yeah.
She's really good in this role.
I would love to have a little bit of insight as to how she viewed playing a founder, because, you know, you often hear actors...
She thought she was Michael Keaton.
There's a joke for a movie that very few people saw.
Yeah. Watch The Founder People, starring Michael Keaton and Linda Cardellini. It was a good one last year.
Yeah. But, you know, Leonard Nimoy talked about when he played Spock, he viewed him as very, like, tactile with his hands. Like, the hands mattered a lot to playing a Vulcan. I would like to know what Salome Jens thought of playing a founder, or how she used her body in that way, and what she thought this character, how this character would perceive the environment around her.
Yeah, and I think we probably get the most out of that when she returns to Odo's life in that Dominion invasion arc there, and she's kind of interacting with him and guiding him, and I think that's probably when we see her maybe with her guard down the most, though. And I think we can be informed a lot by her own physical performance, because it's not just saying the words, though. It's how you're reacting to the words and the actors around you as well.
Right. That's usually how the aliens work the best on a Star Trek show or any other sci-fi property, is how well the actors can bring a body language to that alien species that feels alien.
Yeah. Very quickly, jump over to The Abandoned. This is the episode in which they discover an alien infant. And within a few hours, a few days, they realize it's a Jem'Hadar soldier because it's growing and growing. And it just automatically has this attachment to Odo, who it thinks of as a god. So it's reemphasizing kind of these themes of worship and God within Star Trek Deep Space Nine. We have that a lot with the prophets and the Bajorans, you know. So this is kind of reemphasizing a constant theme going on here. Does this episode necessarily work for you, Cam?
I enjoyed this episode. I don't think it's like a top flight episode of Deep Space Nine, but I enjoyed it, and I like that it does underline a certain tragic element of the Jem'Hadar, and we would see this going forward. Again, Deep Space Nine paid a lot of attention to fleshing out its cannon fodder villains.
Sure.
It did a really good job in giving some really interesting looks into their honor system and all that sort of stuff, but I like that this episode does underline that tragic quality, in that they very much are characters by nature, not by nurture, and that you can try. You can try to raise them over these handful of days before they reach maturity in a proper way. It just doesn't matter.
They are genetically programmed to kill. Even a holographic simulation isn't going to do the trick and fulfill that bloodlust that they're going to have. It's kind of like, what can you do at this point as a mentor to an alien like this?
And it does, I think, underscore a certain evil to the Dominion. Maybe the thing is, when you show the Borg on screen, or see even the Cardassians, a lot of the time they're committing acts that are very easy to say, that's evil. You know, they're attacking Starfleet ships or that sort of thing, whereas the Dominion doesn't really do that until later on. And so it's moments like this, I think, that really get to underscore the type of evil that the Dominion is using that isn't big, flashy explosions and fight scenes. It's like an underlying evil to their conduct that, you know, we'll see Ben Sisko go up against. And I think this episode does a really smart thing in showing how it affects a child with the Jem'Hadar, because that just adds to the certain tragedy to it.
Next episode, Heart of Stone, which is notable here in that the changelings become a rock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe not the strongest episode, having to watch a changeling impersonate Kira as a rock, like, envelops her body.
I remember watching this episode, and, like, I was totally involved with it. I was like, oh my god, Kira's gonna lose her leg or something. Like, it was so suspenseful to me. And then when the big reveal comes that it's the female changeling, I was like, wow, I did not see that coming.
I may mock it a little bit, but I think this is a very important episode with regards to it, because they're establishing, you know, how well the Dominion are, you know, infiltrating, like, those who, you know, are characters are closest to. Right. It's also very important for the Dominion here to understand what Odo's motivation is for sticking by the Alpha Quadrant, and it's that he has feelings for Kira.
Right.
So, it's maybe not the most riveting hour of Deep Space Nine.
I like this episode. It's a really good Odo character episode.
Yeah, but I think it's still an important one for the Dominion here.
Do you think that the Dominion missed out on some opportunities to impersonate more people?
Cam, I want to get into this a little further on, but short answer, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Considering how many founders there are.
Well, we can jump on that too. But yeah. The next time we see them in a very significant way, though, is the die is cast in the Improbable Cause two-parter, in which the Obsidian Order, the Tal Shiar, they're like, yeah, screw it. Let's just get some fleets to go into the Founder's homeworld and just wreck that homeworld that had been discovered in Search Parts 1 and 2.
Right.
It doesn't work out so well.
No, it does not.
Because, of course, you just brought this up here, but there is already a Dominion or a Changeling infiltration underway. And one of the Romulan commanders is, in fact, a Changeling. We also established here that no Changeling has harmed another.
Right.
This is what the fake Romulan commander tells Odo when he helps him escape during this moment. So I think this is also a very important one for kind of establishing the mythos of the Dominion.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And the idea of the Founders being unable to injure or hurt one another is a really interesting idea. It's not really that new to science fiction. It really, you know, you see that in the original Planet of the Apes. The ape will not kill another ape, or I can't remember what the exact wording is, but that's one of the tenets of the Planet of the Apes. And I like the idea of using it here because, again, with Odo, a character who just wants to belong, that puts some interesting stakes on this character where you've just introduced him back to his home world. All of his, you know, fellow changelings are going to introduce war upon Starfleet. So what's an Odo to do? And it creates really interesting stakes for this character because how does he go through these next few seasons without injuring a changeling?
Yeah, so again, this one establishes that the Founders are no longer inhabiting that homeworld that we are introduced to. They've made their escape. And I think the next very important episode that comes up, though, is The Adversary, which is the season finale here in for season 3 of Deep Space Nine.
In which, Odo kills a changeling.
Odo kills a changeling. Yeah. And I think this is really going to be informing a lot of Odo's journey for the remainder of the series here, because he is kind of also an outcast amongst the changelings and amongst the solids as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, so to me, this one, I was kind of bummed out as a season finale.
It does feel like a very...
like a smaller episode, doesn't it?
Smaller, high concept episode, very much modeled on The Thing.
Yeah.
You know, the John Carpenter film, more so than the original.
You know, but you know, it still kind of ends on this note in which the changeling that was just is in the process of getting zapped by the main engineering tube. With a warp core.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The main engineering tube.
Tyler and his articulate ways.
You will never be a Geordi LaForge, sir.
No. I can't even hope to be a Barclay. So, anyway, but
maybe an Argyle.
I can only hope to be an Argyle. Maybe a Selena Gomez. I could be a Selena Gomez. Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, but we have the changing say, look, we're already everywhere.
Yeah.
And which is kind of a spooky note to leave off on.
That reminds me of was it Quantum of Solace, where they say we have people everywhere, and then M says people say it all the time, we didn't think they actually meant it.
Yeah
That's such a great line and very true to these changelings.
Well, apparently didn't really convince Paramount that much, because we get into season 4 and they're like, yeah, the Klingons are now the adversaries, and
yeah,
it's just kind of like, oh, okay. I mean, I love Way of the Warrior.
Yeah.
I thought that's a great one, but they kind of put the Dominion on the back burner in
this
season.
Why do you think they did that?
I think Paramount found they just weren't interested in it. And I think Paramount said, well, look, people gravitate towards what's familiar.
Sure.
The Klingons are very familiar. They're very iconic. And I think if they're going to put down money on bringing Michael Dorn back onto the series, they want to make sure that Michael Dorn has a lot to do.
Yeah.
So I can understand it. You know,
it also makes sense from the point of view, if you're a studio, and look, it's so easy to look in retrospect and be like, they were really stupid. The Dominion were obviously awesome.
Sure.
But if you are that studio,
and you don't know what's coming as a studio.
Exactly. You're looking at from the point of view of seasons 2 and 3, looking at the show, and it's like, it's a very slow burn build to the Dominion, right?
And it's also very serialized, which is not really what
they wanted. And so the Dominion is entirely unfamiliar to them. And it's like, where is this going, guys? It's not going there in a hurry.
Yeah.
We were dealing with Bajoran politics for the first 2 years. So I understand 100% why they would want to probably goose ratings with the Klingons.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
But the next notable Dominion episode, though, is Hippocratic Oath, in which the Chief and Bashir crash land on that planet where we encounter the Jem'Hadar, who finds that he's no longer addicted to Ketracel White.
Right.
And so Bashir's like, great. I'm going to make sure none of the Jem'Hadar are addicted to Ketracel White.
Idealistic young Bashir.
So there's a couple problems with this. Like,
sure.
Okay, so let's say he accomplishes that. Well, it means that the Jem'Hadar can run wild across the Gamma Quadrant.
Right.
I don't know how many lives will, you know, be lost due to that.
Yeah.
And it's, is it really up to Bashir to, I guess, interfere in the development of his species in this way? It's tough, because based on what we know of the Jem'Hadar, they are just kind of killing machines, albeit sentient killing machines. So
And they're manipulated by another species as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like that symbiosis episode of Next Generation.
Sure. <Yeah.
laughs> Drugs will make you feel good, but they're bad. And, you know, I like this episode in that, once again, it's introducing shades to these Jem'Hadar, which, again, could have been one-note killers.
Yeah.
Easily. And, you know, I can totally get on board with the Bashir story. It makes sense with this character, why he would want to do this. But it also makes sense why O'Brien's there being like, this is a bad idea, and we got to get out of here now.
Yeah.
So I totally buy it, and I think it's interesting for what it does with the Jem'Hadar. Again, you know, we've talked about it in the previous ones. It just gives that extra bit of tragedy to them, which I think is important for an alien that... All we're told about with the Jem'Hadar a lot of the time is that there's a lot of them and there's a lot of destruction that's involving them. So just introducing elements like this lets us kind of graph that knowledge onto the larger force, because the show doesn't have the time or the budget to be digging into all these individual stories.
No.
So I like that. And it's interesting, though, you know, with the Dominion at this point, with this episode, there was a quote from Citadel Fidel where they were talking to him about the Dominion in season 4 around the time they're shooting this episode. And he said, I don't think the Dominion have gotten to first base with regard to being a serious threat. Hmm. I don't think anybody bites their nails over them.
Oh, wow.
So you could see, like, early on, the cast was not really on board. And Terry Farrell was maybe a little more diplomatic, but she was also like, I don't know that we should be doing these.
If only we could go back in time and tell them that you'd be spending a 2-season serialized arc all about them to finish off.
In the next 20 years being asked about them at conventions.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Just one last note, though. This one is notable in that the Jem'Hadar soldier who was no longer addicted, he ended up choosing to stay behind with his garrison, despite the fact that he knew that they were going to kill him. And he says to O'Brien, why don't you explain it? You're a soldier, too. You explain it to your doctor. Because there's a lot of good conflict going on between O'Brien and Bashir. And honestly, like, you're meant to think, like, O'Brien's being kind of a dink.
Right.
But I kind of agree with him. Like, why are you trying to unleash these killing machines upon the rest of the galaxy? Like, your job should be to escape and get back home.
No, 100%.
Yeah. Next very important episode here, Homefront and Paradise Lost.
Right.
The bird reference that you made, Cameron. But look, I think this is important. We have that Antwerp bombing in which the Dominion is blamed for that. And so they're like, okay, well, let's really lock down the UFP. Let's emphasize what a danger the Dominion is at this point. And so we have another Bad Apple episode with regards
Admiral Layton.
Admirals and, you know, all their bad judgment here. I want to highlight, which I think is one of the most important, you know, kind of moments within this two-parter, but that is the Changeling O'Brien scene with Sisko.
Right, the very JFK moment.
Exactly.
The Oliver Stone movie JFK, not the actual president.
Right, right. But essentially he says, look, there's only one of us here. Or maybe he's either one of us or like five of us.
Right.
Either way, it was an incredibly small number. And he's like, and look at all of the chaos we've been able to unleash with just that.
Yeah.
And I think this is where they start to kind of get scary. Mm-hmm. And I think we can maybe debate now about whether they ever lived up to that kind of infiltration threat that had been lingering overhead for a long, long time. I'd like the idea that anybody could be a changeling at any moment. We have the Federation devising, say, those phaser sweeps, taking blood samples.
Yeah.
We also figure out this is the moment where Section 31 would have introduced the changeling disease into Odo, who would have brought it back to the Great Link. I don't know, but do we live up to the promised threat of these infiltrators, Cam?
No, I don't think we do. But the show doesn't spend a lot of time on Earth as is. Like, do we really want to see Earth in the grip of paranoia?
No. I'm talking about, like, how there could be changelings aboard the station.
Sure.
They're, you know, and, you know, I wonder if maybe they felt that they had already, you know, spent that with regards to the next two-parter that we'll be discussing.
I wonder if part of it was is that that seems like such an obvious tactic that maybe the Dominion's intention was more to make you know, Starfleet all paranoid and wrapped up with thinking there's founders everywhere, whereas that's not what their tactics actually are.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to do it, where they're just trying to, you know, basically point them in one direction, then run the other.
I just felt as if there's maybe a missed opportunity for more paranoia, you know.
I agree.
And maybe more reveals. But the thing is, like, I think you could fall into the trap where you have a tough time investing in the characters if you think that at any moment there could be, you know, like a switcheroo on you.
Yeah.
And I think it worked, you know, spoiler alert for the Bashir reveal.
Yeah.
I think if they kept going to that well, I think we would have gotten a little sick of it.
I wonder if it's something they just felt had been done too much, too.
What do you mean?
Of just the imposter versions of characters and that sort of thing, like that being kind of the alien threat.
I don't think it had really...
I know X-Files had done it quite a bit at that point early on.
I really don't think... Yeah. This would have been, you know, contemporaneous with X-Files at the time. Like, I don't think that was on their mind.
Hmm.
You know, and I'll say this, though. This actually, these kind of themes were explored further, you know, in, say, the early 2000s. And,
right.
With, I know that Dollhouse was doing that a lot. I know that Battlestar Galactica did it quite well. There's other series that were really jumping on this. And I think kind of cultivating a lot of good storytelling that I think Deep Space Nine just kind of, like, shrugged off at that point.
Right. So,
otherwise, I think this is an interesting two-parter that really kind of starts to establish why these should be threatening and why it actually poses a threat to kind of the principles of the Federation, in which, you know, Federation can betray its own principles here.
And it also shows how fragile the Federation can be, too. With a little bit of paranoia, they're about ready to collapse.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
You know, it's that whole chaos Joker speech from The Dark Knight all over again.
Who's the unstoppable force and immovable object?
Well, I think it's Starfleet and the Dominion.
No, but which one's which?
Oh, which one's the unstoppable? I would say that's... Oh, that's the Dominion, and the immovable is Federation and Starfleet.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about...
Solved.
Yeah. That's going on our best of.
Yeah, no kidding.
Let's talk about To the Death, which I think is probably the best Jem'Hadar episode that we get. This is where there's an insurrection going on amongst Jem'Hadar, who find that Akonian gateway, and they'll have access to anywhere in the galaxy and
right.
could create even more insurrection across the Dominion and, again, the rest of the universe.
I was hoping that gateway was going to talk like the gateway from City on the Edge of Forever.
Oh, yeah.
Like, where do you want to go?
And we find out it's just like a Jem'Hadar soldier doing the voice behind everyone. Yeah. But look, this is great at establishing something, because they're talking about Ketracel White, mm-hmm. and this is where Wei-Yun says, well, maybe the Founder's ability to control the Jem'Hadar is overstated. That's why we need this Ketracel White. And
yeah.
I think this is really good. They're not quite programmed to worship these Founder gods the way that maybe we think they are, and that's why they have this drug addiction going forward.
Right.
I just love an episode in which, look, you get to know a lot of our antagonists from Star Trek, and the more you get to know them, you're like, I kind of dig them. They're cool. This is not what happens here with the Jem'Hadar. The more you find out about them, the more effed up you think that they are.
They become a very unstable element.
Yes.
Whereas you would think of them immediately as kind of like your stormtroopers from Star Wars. You know, it's like they're just the army that's going in, whereas you understand at this point forward that, like, they're like real wild cards.
They're not cannon fodder. Where,
no.
You know, let's talk about that wild card element, in which they kept really poking at Worf,
yeah.
and trying to get a rise out of him, and it worked every effing time. Worf
has very thin skin, though.
He really does, you know. Yeah. But I think, honestly, they wanted to say or see what it was like to take on a Klingon. I can understand why the guy's second would keep doing that. And then his punishment, like, Worf gets sent to his bedroom, and the second has his neck cracked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm just like, these guys are scary.
Yeah.
You know, but it's their way of maintaining order. And what we know about the Dominion is it's all about order.
Mm-hmm.
For us, I think we should also bring up, this is the introduction of one Wei-Yun here.
One of the greats.
And I think that the writers realized they made a mistake by killing him off, which is why they had to introduce the cloning thing in a later episode. But what do you make of, like, let's be honest, Wei-Yun is the ultimate Vorta, right? But did he pop out to you the first time you saw To the Death, Cam?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think I would definitely have perked up at seeing Jeffrey Combs.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that he immediately Wayun jumped out at me as like, this is going to be an all-timer villain on the show, especially not once he died.
Sure. Yeah.
I think it was kind of like, okay, well, he was a fine one and done, but I don't know that he popped for me. I think a lot of Wayun's greatness comes from this, the development of that character over time.
Mm.
In a single episode, I don't know that he necessarily leaves the imprint that we would obviously get. It's very hard to say.
I would say on subsequent viewings, though, this really pops, though. Yeah. Like, you kind of...
Don't you find that with a lot of these episodes, though? Like, at the time, you're like, yeah, okay, where's this going? Exactly. What's next? And then you go back and watch a single isolated one.
And you're like,
oh, wow, this is a great episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is also the episode where I was alluding to at the very start of this one, where they established that, you know, the Jem'Hadar, they don't sleep, they don't eat, they don't have sex.
Right.
There are no Jem'Hadar women either.
Yeah.
They really don't live, aren't expected to live past 30. Like, most, like, if you get to age 20, you're considered an honored elder.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was interesting, so... yeah, and the first that we follow for most of this, which was that Clarence Williams the third, I think?
I believe.
Okay. I could be mistaken, but yeah. He was like, I'm eight. Like, I'm,
right.
You know, pretty hardcore as like an eight-year-old.
Yes.
So, again, these are still children by human standards.
And I like that, again, he has this sort of, that one has a certain grudging respect with Sisko at the end.
Yeah.
Again, it's giving depth to these characters who... would not get depth in another show.
You're right. What did you think of his promise to kill Sisko when he got the chance?
Like, hey, he never got to put that into action.
No, it's kind of like, if I was Sisko, I would have taken Worf's advice, which is like, yeah, maybe I'll just stick this one out. I am the captain. I should be on the ship as opposed to fighting like soldiers.
It really is crazy when you look in retrospect at what Sisko was doing.
Yeah.
It's... so outside of the norm of like your leader just like charging into battle.
Yes.
It's very Captain America and Black Panther in Infinity War.
Oh, it's funny. We just watched, not you and I, but my girlfriend and I, we just watched Black Panther last night.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there you go.
Well, there you go.
Okay. Ties it all together. Let's jump to the season finale here. Broken Link, in which they return Odo back to the Great Link,
mm-hmm.
and he comes out as a solid with the little tidbit here that, hey, I found out within the Great Link that it's in fact Gowron who has been infiltrating the Klingon Empire. we can discuss that in a moment.
Yeah.
That's what Odo has been told.
I like the idea, though, that Odo has to go back to the Link because the Founders have made him sick.
Yes, yes.
Like, they're willing to do that to one of their own. You know, it's this whole, we will not kill another Founder, but we'll make him really, really sick, so he has to come home.
Give him a tummy ache.
Yeah, give him a virus that draws him back home.
Yeah.
And then basically implanting ideas into his head.
Yeah.
And that's pretty twisted.
What did you think about this punishment that he had to endure for killing another changing, which is to make, like, they're not going to kill Odo, but they're going to make him solid.
It's, well, not just solid, but they're going to make him look the way he looked as a changeling. Yeah. So he doesn't even blend into more, you know, solid society.
Oh, it's multicultural. Well, anyway, everybody looks like an alien, right?
I guess. Although I never was 100% clear, just because there's so many aliens on Star Trek, whether Odo stood out to the rest as weird.
Yeah, it's true. Like, I never really thought about that.
Yeah.
No, I think it's just the Dr. Mora haircut that stood out as really weird. Yeah. But we do find out in the next episode that, look, it's pretty easy for Odo to undergo plastic surgery and look like a Klingon. He could have looked like a Bajoran if he wanted, you know.
What if he never took that Klingon makeup off?
That'd be, and he just does the rest. Do you know what he's doing? He's trolling Worf from Hippocratic Oath, because that was the episode where Worf and Odo were going, pushing back against each other about who's really chief of security now.
Right.
It'd be great if he just trolled Worf like that the rest of the time.
But, you know, this punishment is very much tapping into Odo's insecurities as well.
Sure.
Like, the female changeling and all of these changelings, they're very canny in what they're doing to Odo.
Yeah.
This is pretty brutal.
Yeah, maybe we should have talked about this back in the search parts in 1 and 2, but what do you make of kind of the concept behind the Great Link? Because this is so integral to kind of, I guess, the Dominion as a concept.
I think it's really great because I think a lot of shows or movies, when you introduce an alien threat or a villain threat, they give them a face immediately. Whereas what I like about the Great Link is it's something that you almost can't reason with because it's just such an alien concept. I mean, yes, Odo can go down and talk to the female changeling. But when you actually see the Great Link, if you're just like Sisko bombing in there and you're defiant,
yeah,
it's like, what are you going to do?
Like, you don't even dip have your toes.
Yeah, you don't even have the ability to, like, really
yell at it?
exchange a dialogue with them if they don't want to talk to you or communicate with you.
Put a straw in and blow. Right.
It's like skipping stones across them. Which actually, wasn't Bashir going to do that in an episode?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was. That was a good joke.
Really funny.
Yeah, yeah. Sisko's like, cannonball!
He's got like the same bathing suit he's wearing in Emissary.
It's like, Marco!
So I think the next one that we should bring up here, though, is, I guess, the resolution to the Broken Link, which is the Begotten, in which they find a sick baby changeling, one who can't even take any form at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And we really have Odo trying to take on that mentorship role that he wished he had, because the first months or years of his life, he was stuck in Dr. Moore's lab getting experimented on, and you really get the sense that it was traumatic for Odo.
Big time,
and
yeah.
I think he wanted to save the sick baby changeling from this fate as well.
I think this was a good time to bring Dr. Moore back, because you have Odo having found his home world and feeling like an outsider with his home world. And now in this episode, you get, you know, he never felt like he had a good father-son relationship with Dr. Moore at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to see more of the development of that in contrast to where Odo felt he always wanted to be and realizing that maybe he didn't.
Yeah. The resolution here, I'm not quite sure what to make of the physics of the baby changeling absorbing itself into solid Odo, and Odo suddenly becomes a changeling again.
That was, I think, a writerly convenience.
I just kind of had to shrug. I'm like, well, it's not sci-fi. It's more like sci-magic, I guess. I was like, okay, but
it's
an
alien, way of life you'll never understand.
But what did you think of the journey of, I guess we got like 3/4 of a season of, say, solid Odo. What did you think of that?
I mean, it definitely tapped into the tragedy of that character and this constant sense of insecurity and not belonging. And I think they used it as much as they could. Like, I never felt like they undercut it or they got rid of it too quickly. You know, you look at, say, 7 of 9 going from full Borg into, catsuit in like 2 episodes.
Yeah.
I feel like with the solid Odo, they got their stories out of it, but they didn't overstay its welcome. Ultimately, don't we all want to see shapeshifter Odo?
That's true.
So it made sense.
Well, the budget department never did.
That's very true.
I'll say that. Yeah. Next important one here, and just maybe one, very briefly though, is Ties of Blood and War, which is really more of a Kira episode, but it has Wei Yun come into the picture, and we're like, wait, didn't Wei Yun just die? Mm-hmm. And they had actually established the cloning procedure for the Vorta. At the time, I thought that it was kind of cheap. I thought that it was kind of lame.
Jeffrey Combs didn't.
No.
He's like, genius.
Hell no. But you know what?
He's the one that wrote it.
But it becomes so, part and parcel of what we understand about the Dominion and the Vorta. In retrospect, it makes so much more sense to me that, look, they recognized they had a great actor playing an alien that they wanted to spend way more time with here in the Vorta. And I think this is a kind of a good solution, and it really made sense within everything that we knew was established about the Dominion so far.
Yeah. It's interesting that they so much decided on Jeffrey Combs, because I would not really say there's a weak link in terms of their Vorta casting.
No.
Because there's a couple actresses play Vorta earlier, and I think they're both great. I never felt like, boy, they're really stumbling around trying to figure out who their lead Vorta was going to be before they found this one. It seemed like all of them were really, really strong and memorable.
And when we're introduced to Kivon in the Dominion Invasion War in Rocks and Shoals, let's say they never found Jeffrey Combs. I think that Kivon could have been the one taking that mantle. Like, Kivon was really great.
Even the one in Magnificent Ferengi is really memorable.
Iggy Pop?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I agree.
He's great.
I had a fun time. I've probably mentioned this on the podcast before, but I got to talk to Irish Stephen Bear in depth in Vegas about working with Iggy Pop, back in the day. Like, I remember when I saw that episode, I knew who Iggy Pop was, but it was 1990s Iggy Pop. Yeah. It was kind of that weird, it's before, he becomes legendary sort of Iggy Pop. It's just, so I didn't really get why it was such a big deal that Iggy Pop was on DS9 in the late 90s.
How many years is this after Trainspotting? Because that kind of gave him a bit of a rebirth.
This would have been within 2 years? 2 years,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah.
So I just didn't get the big deal at the time when I was a teenager. And then rewatching this in later years, I'm like, holy F, it's Iggy Pop. And so I had a great time talking to Irish Stephen Bear about that. It would have been great if Iggy Pop was the go-to Vorta, as we know it. I think he would have done it.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
He was in The Crow Part 2. He sure would have done Star Trek.
Sure. I believe it. Stepping backwards, though, I think very importantly, we need to talk about In Purgatory's Shadow and By Inferno's Light, in which they reveal Bashir, as we know it, pre-First Contact uniform, has been kidnapped by the Dominion, and a changeling has been performing brain surgery on Sisko, and...
it was a very smart changeling.
Delivered Kira Yoshi for the O'Briens.
Yeah.
The very bold choice to go with that.
I can just imagine this changeling communicating home at the end of each of these days, being like, you're not going to believe what I'm having to do here.
You know, Garrick just keeps talking my ear off.
You wouldn't believe the day I've just had.
Yeah. Jadzia's still going out with Worf.
Yeah. Yeah, it just turns into a gossip. They stop giving any sort of tactics about the Federation and yeah. Starfleet. They're just like giving gossip.
And you wouldn't believe Lita and Jadzia are no longer best friends.
Odo totally likes Kira, but Kira doesn't know.
Actually, you know, they would have known that by
the
Heart of Stone.
Yeah,
they would
have known that. Yeah, you're right.
You know, I'm sure there's dishing stuff about like, hey, Odo's no longer a solid.
Right.
You know? So I think it's kind of interesting. This, to me, kind of lives up to the potential of what was established with kind of that infiltration threat. I really like this reveal here. And very importantly, we also have the reveal that Martok was actually kind of the infiltrator,
right,
which we knew based yes. on Apocalypse Rising. But what we didn't know is that the original Martok was alive and kicking and getting his butt kicked, losing eyes in
yeah.
these Jem'Hadar death matches. And again, this might be Worf's, you know, like, baddest ass moment in all of Star Trek, where he's just enduring the nonstop Jem'Hadar death match.
Oh, it's amazing.
You know?
That moment of him just taking on Jem'Hadar after Jem'Hadar is infinitely more badass, that single few minutes, than any second of Next Generation.
Where he just gets pushed on the ground
There's
every single episode?
There's nothing in Next Generation that comes close to this.
What about when he's doing his martial arts in front of a class?
Or battling Skeletor on the holodeck.
Yeah.
No, it's just so great. But, you know, I know Siddig Al-Fadel has said that he really, really wishes they'd let him know that he was playing
right.
a changeling early on.
Right.
And I think that's... I don't have a lot of real complaints about Deep Space Nine and the way it executed. You know, there's some things you wish it may have changed or whatever, but I think overall it holds together incredibly, incredibly well. But I would have liked to have seen some storytelling done with changeling Bashir, as opposed to just kind of a reveal and being like, okay, well,
yeah.
Sure.
So, okay, yeah. So I would agree with you in that I think the reveal is cool, but I think we would have gotten better storytelling possibilities had we, like, there would have been more tension. We would
right.
have been like, oh, what is he going to do next? Should the crew be delivering this piece of information here?
Or you just had some sort of development in Bashir's role on the station, or a relationship or something, just something on the show, so that when it's revealed that he's a changeling, like, what does that draw out of the other characters who involved in that evolution of the character?
Yeah, and look, I think Battlestar Galactica actually seizes on that particular thing, because there's that big infiltration thread throughout that series, and they always dealt with the consequences
yeah.
of discovering that. So it's kind of, and it was also kind of lame that they ended this changeling arc with him like blowing up in a runabout.
Yeah.
I'm just like, okay.
Yeah, I did not like that.
No,
it was
kind of lame. But again, this is a very, very important episode in that we find a very weakened Cardassia, which
yeah.
Had fallen victim to, I would say, Martok's infiltration here, in which we have the Klingon aggression against Cardassia, weakens Cardassia, and Dukat convinces, I guess, you know, the remnants of the Cardassian government to join the Dominion.
Yeah.
This is kind of mind-blowing. You know, you really
Although
see...
Although you think you would have seen it coming from a mile away, considering how set up the Cardassians were right from day one.
Yeah, but did you see this coming?
No, not at all.
I never saw it coming. Yeah.
Not at all.
So, I mean, I was like, oh, wow. And you really think about what this means for the implications moving forward. And if there's any question about whether war with the Dominion was imminent, I think this put it to rest. You're like, oh, there is going to be kind of a breaking point coming up very soon, now that the Dominion's like, oh, remember how we told you don't go in the Gamma Quadrant? Well, I guess we're going to have a lot of fun here in the Alpha Quadrant, guys.
I would be fascinated to know what the studio thought of these ongoing developments with this show. Because, look, as Star Trek fans, we take this stuff at face value. Like, we really get it. We don't require long explanations as to what is going on. Whereas, like, if you're a studio, you're not necessarily watching these shows.
Right.
Are you sitting there reading log lines for these episodes being like, what the hell are you guys even doing?
Ducat would never do that.
Yeah. You know, the studio aren't Star Trek fans necessarily.
Yeah.
So I would have been fascinated to know how the show is being explained to them as it's evolving.
Yeah. But look, this propels them to the invasion arc with A Time to Stand through to Sacrifice of Angels.
Yeah.
Look, we go way more in depth in our previous episodes. Cam, I think you can maybe post a link.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. We have an episode all about the invasion arc. I'll post a link to that in the show notes. It's a very popular episode, so I feel like most people that listen have heard it, but if you haven't, it'll be there.
But I look, there's a couple important Dominion-centric episodes. I think Rocks and Shoals, again, more establishment of the very tenuous grip of leadership that maybe the Vorta can hold over the Jem'Hadar and what it means when you run out of Ketrasol light.
And also just the depths they'll sink to. Because the Vorta in that is really awful.
Oh, God.
And is just basically has all of his Jem'Hadars wiped out.
Yeah, Kivon's like, well, I see writing on the wall, and I can still order the Jem'Hadar to do as I please. And even though the Jem'Hadar knows it's a trap, they're still going to do this. And I think the Jem'Hadar are kind of okay. This is their duty. This is what they live for. Whether they live, none of them expects to live to like be an honored elder at age 20. So it's just part of... Death is part of life.
Right.
The other, I think, big factor here is how the female changeling is able to influence Odo so dramatically on this. And I found this to be very frustrating as a viewer. But in terms of the evolution of the Dominion, I think what's important, though, is that it establishes that the founders consider Odo far more valuable to them than, you know, their grasp on the Alpha Quadrant.
What's interesting is we see that the founders are giving Ketrasol White to the Jem'Hadar. It's this drug that is essentially keeping them hooked. In many ways, the female changeling offers the same thing to Odo through these contacts, you know, where they meld together. It's basically a narcotic to Odo and really does cause him to commit behaviors that he would never do towards his friends. And it is because he's addicted to this great link. I think it's a really interesting idea of these evil forces who are very much intoxicating those they want to control.
I never even thought about that one. I think that's really insightful there.
Well, thank you.
Well, of course, yeah.
There's a clip for the best of.
But I also just like the fact that the female shapeshifter approaches Odo because she is isolated from the Great Link as well, and she feels lonely. Like, she hasn't gone this long without linking with another founder. And I think this is also very important in informing why Odo might just have this kind of, like, unexplainable feeling of isolation within him. You know, this is not something he's ever really been able to experience throughout his entire life, his existence, you know.
And I do love what this does to that character of Odo, where he's just like, nothing else matters at this moment.
Yeah.
You know.
Do we know how old Odo is when we meet him? And I mean, I know, you know.
Oh, don't ask me Star Trek ages.
Yeah, but is he supposed to be like 20 or 30? Is that kind of the idea?
I mean, that makes sense. Yeah. I don't know.
Because like, I know Rene Aubergeron, I think Rene Aubergeron is actually much older than how old Odo is supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I think he's probably supposed to be like 30 or something. Because it's like, you look at Dr.
He's a similar age as Kira?
I don't know. You look at Dr. Mora.
Yeah.
And how old is Dr. Mora?
Probably 50s?
Yeah.
Although he might have been playing a little older, maybe like low 60s.
But that tells me that Odo is probably only about 30 himself.
Sure.
At the time that we meet him.
Yeah, you know? So maybe he's maybe like mid-30s at this point in time.
Yeah. But again, it's kind of like the Jem'Hadar 8-year-old that we met.
Yeah.
We would consider that to be, you know, kind of a different age for a human, whereas, you know, for different aliens, maturity is at different levels.
No, exactly.
So,
some humans never mature.
You're speaking to one of them. Again, go to our invasion arc episode. We'll go into even more depths. Those are just kind of the two big things that I wanted to highlight here. Very briefly, one episode that I don't know if many people think about as an important Dominion evolution episode, though, is One Little Ship.
Yes.
In which we have the Jem'Hadar take over the Defiant very temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
But we see that there is tension because there are the Jem'Hadar that were originally bred in the Gamma Quadrant, and the new breed of Jem'Hadar bred right here in the Alpha Quadrant. And I thought at the time when I watched this, like, oh, they're planting seeds for something.
And they weren't.
And they weren't. I was very disappointed that they never really followed this up, because I think it's actually very interesting about how they can have an even more aggressive sort of Jem'Hadar going up against, you know, our characters. And it's always good when you have that that growing danger associated with your antagonist. It's not like they get, you know, cute and cuddly as you get to know them more. They get more dangerous.
It is, but it also does run the the risk of turning into that, you know, you thought Shredder was bad. What about Super Shredder?
Like too much escalation?
Yeah, then, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
I mean, I was fine with it not going anywhere, but I did like that they touched on that idea in this episode. Yeah. And it would have been interesting to see down the road, if they'd had more time, just more of a meeting between these Gamma Quadrant, Jem'Hadar, and the Alpha Quadrant, and how they work with one another. I think that would have been really interesting.
Yeah. Let's jump over to Treachery, Faith, and the Great River. This is where we have a defective Weyoun try to defect to the Federation. And
I see what you did there.
Yeah, yeah. And he and Odo go on a road trip together. This is kind
of like Thelma and Louise.
Well, you know, I think this is a real underrated episode, though. Like,
it's a really great episode for mythology for Vorta.
And it establishes everything from the fact that they started off as like ape-like tree dwellers that were being rewarded by the founders for, you know, saving them after being attacked by a mob of solids.
Going back to the whole woodland nymph idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We also just have this re-emphasis of how much, you know, they worship the founders literally as gods. And there's a great line there where Odo's like, don't you think that maybe they programmed you to worship them? And Weyoun's like, well, yeah, what's the point of being a god if there's no one there to worship you?
Yeah.
I thought that was like a real fun line that they had going on in this one. I also want to throw this question at you. So there's Weyoun 6, who is the defector.
Yep.
And then there's the Weyoun 7, who is willing to like let the Jem'Hadar kill Odo unknowingly in the runabout.
Right.
Is the Weyoun 7 potentially defective as well, if that he's willing to allow a god to perish in order to prevent the defector from releasing information? He does not, he and Damar do not want to tell the female changeling about what's going on here.
Yeah. That's an excellent question. You wonder how much talk is just going in between the members of the ship, between like, you know, he's not even like a member of the Dominion that's actually on our side.
Sure, yeah.
He's kind of the outcast member of the changeling.
He's the first one to ever harm another changeling.
Yeah. If something happens to him, maybe it's not such a tragedy. I think that would be very difficult to deal with as like a Vorta who worship the changeling. That's something I think they could have delved into a little more, like with the character of Odo.
Yeah.
And how a Vorta who is engineered to worship them as gods deals with one who is really fighting back against the idea of being a god, and also doing things that are completely contrary to what the rest of them are saying needs to be done. But, I mean, is this one defective? I don't know. I never really thought of it that way.
It's just Weyoun being Weyoun?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I feel like Weyoun, once he is given a directive and a mission, he's going to try and pursue it, although he is trying to secretly do this, so I don't know.
I should have said off the bat, you know, the reason why Weyoun 6 is considered effective, though, is because he's questioning the Dominion. He's like, why are they pursuing war? It just seems stupid. And you're not supposed to question your orders if you're a Vorta at all.
Yeah.
So this is also a very significant one in that we see that the female changeling has a disease.
Yeah.
And where did you think this particular arc was going? Did you predict every step of the way, Cam?
I don't know. I never dawned on me it was a Section 31 virus.
Sure.
But
that did not dawn on me either. But I never like watching like disease or virus arcs in like shows.
I hate that episode, The Quickening. I hate it. It's so unpleasant for me to watch.
It just takes away so much agency from our characters, where it's something out of their control. So we just have to watch them deteriorate until somebody finds a cure. I'm like, okay.
I mean, the thing about the female changeling is I don't know that it popped out to me in a hugely significant way, just because we'd seen Odo get sick multiple times. So I figured it's going somewhere, but it wasn't like, what is happening?
Yeah.
It was like, okay, we're going to get some sort of plot here.
I thought it was going to play into kind of the final arc.
Right.
Like I
that makes sense. You are getting to that point in the series.
And I was really antsy about having this entire thing resolved because of a disease. Like, I thought there was going to be some sort of peace treaty signed so that they could work together and cure this disease.
Right.
I'm not the biggest fan of the disease storyline that we get here that's established here myself.
I mean, I like it in the sense that, you know, it does kind of showcase that very, you know, sadistic side of war, and that people commit some terrible acts to end a war.
This is why you're a big Giorgio fan, and you really want her to get that Section 31.
That's what I'm hoping for. Yeah. Viruses all around.
Very briefly,
that'd be amazing if every finale of every season of Giorgio ended with her infecting an alien species with a virus.
Yeah, can't wait. Chimera.
Yeah.
In which we meet Las, played by one J.G. Hertzler, going under a different stage name, which is fun. Mm-hmm. But essentially, it's another infant changeling that is encountered here. But this one is actually a little bit more advanced than Odo. He figured out how to become like a space whale that can travel at warp speed, which is...
Harry Mudd's riding inside of him.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't get the physics of these founders, but I'll just go with it here. Yeah. And this is interesting just to see how their own experiences diverge so much. And Las has very, very little care for life with solids. He doesn't really understand why Odo would care so much about being with the solids.
Well, I mean...
He had a far worse experience with the solids as well.
For sure. And that is a fundamental philosophy of the founders, is that, you know, they are superior to solids.
Yeah.
Period. And so Loss is, in many ways, a much more true founder. Like, he, even though, like, you know, Odo, he was raised well outside of the influence of your primary founders and the Great Link, he somehow has developed the philosophies that they share, whereas Odo has gone a different way. And it just, I think, is interesting in that you just see how experience can shape them to a certain degree, whereas we've seen in other species like your Jem'Hadar that they are engineered by nature, not by nurture.
Right.
Whereas you see with these Odo versus Lost, like, it's much more of nurture for them.
Is Lost dead?
I think so.
He has
I don't
to be
really know.
Because he never gets any access to the cure.
Yeah.
So, sorry for your loss.
You don't want to know about the final days of Loss.
No.
They were grim.
So look, why don't we cap it off here with the final chapter of Deep Space Nine. Again, we go into more detail on this when we go look at our two-part review of What You Leave Behind. I think with regards to the mythology of, you know, the Dominion, what we find out here is how far they're willing to go to enact their own sense of justice. They see that the Cardassians have betrayed them, so they're going to obliterate every single Cardassian that they can.
Yeah.
Is this where you can understand the motivation of the Dominion up until this point?
Yeah.
That they had perceived aggression from the Federation. They were, you know, blah, blah, blah. But at this point, this is where, like, oh, you guys are just, like, evil.
Well, you know, I think of... Did you ever see the movie Downfall?
With David Schwimmer?
No, the one about the final days of Hitler.
I did see that, yeah.
You know, you see in that film, which is, you know, a fictional take on Hitler's final days in the bunker, how when essentially he's lost, the Allies are approaching, he's losing his mind. He's in a room commanding fake armies and all that sort of stuff. I kind of feel like that's where the founders get at a certain point. It's like, what are you guys even doing at this point? Like, they feel so unfocused.
And we speculate maybe she was suffering from the effects of
the virus. Increasing pressure of the Federation fighting back harder and harder.
Yeah.
And it just feels like at this point, the Dominion just kind of crumbled. Like, yes, they were still hugely powerful and had a lot of influence, but it feels like just the command center and the female changeling was just kind of losing it.
So, Cam, where does the Dominion go from here? They've signed the peace treaty. They retreat from the Alpha Quadrant.
I want to, touch on one
thing.
Oh,
sorry. Yeah.
I really like when they introduce the Breen.
Sure.
And they're just, like, handing over Cardassian planets to the Breen.
Yeah.
What did you think of the Breen as, like, an addition to this Dominion force?
Okay, my brain, I was like, there must be more significant Alpha Quadrant aliens that, you know, they could have tapped.
Like the Sona?
Sure. That they could have tapped to join the Dominion.
Yeah.
The Orions, for one.
Sure.
I'm even curious if they somehow... I don't think it would have made sense for the characters, but what if the Ferengi, or at least a band of Ferengi, had, you know, agreed to do this? The Sona... Or, no, not the Sona. the Breen, though, it's an interesting choice, and I think the writers are just like, yeah, they're mysterious.
Yeah.
They look cool. Why not, you know?
Yeah.
So...
I like the Breen as an idea, a visual idea. They look really cool, and I like that you can't understand a thing they say. I think that's fun. I just wish it was probably too late in the game to start developing all these facets to the Breen after we've spent already so much time on the Vorta and the Demidar.
Casey Biggs all of a sudden became like a regular on the series final arc, where it's like, oh, this is a Casey Biggs show all of a sudden.
They already had so much to wrap up with Deep Space Nine. I just think it would have been fun to see just a little more depth on the Breen, like one episode.
Yeah.
One episode where I understood something about the Breen.
We could have skipped that O'Brien and Bashir trapped in Sloan's mind episode, done a Breen-centric one instead. Yeah.
Because the Breen aren't cannon fodder in the way that they treat the Jem Hadar. Like, the Breen
they've got a scary-ass weapon.
They do, yeah. And they are the ones that attack Earth.
Yeah.
And it feels like the Breen are a very smart, intelligent adversary. I'd just like to know why. And I never really get a sense of why they are.
Maybe we'll find out in the Picard spinoff. which maybe kind of brings us to the next question, though. Where does Dominion go from here? In our own imagination, perhaps. Look, they have the influence of Odo back in the Great Lank.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if this devastating war makes them rethink things. We also know that the female changeling is arrested.
Yeah.
Imprisoned somewhere, I guess, for a long time.
I don't know, because we've seen in the original series, like, the way they deal with criminals is to kind of reprogram them or rehabilitate them in humane ways. So I don't know, maybe the female changeling's like cured in no time. I really don't know. Like, I would like them to revisit the concept of how they deal with criminals in the future.
She ordered the death of a billion people.
Like, I know.
Yeah. Okay.
But I mean, how long does she live? How long are they going to imprison her for?
I know. Like, she's pretty much eternal.
Yeah.
So, but where does Dominion go from here? Because they make the retreat from the Alpha Quadrant. I don't really think there's going to be much of a Dominion threat in the hypothetical future of the UFP.
Yeah.
Or of the Alpha Quadrant. So do they become a more insular sort of culture? Is Odo having an influence in what he's saying?
He's taking some of his Federation ideals back to the Dominion?
Yeah, or even his experience with the Solids. Because I think the Dominion are informed very much by how they were constantly being attacked by Solids, for thousands of years. I don't know. Like, I don't have any fantastic, insights about what makes the most sense for the Dominion moving forward. Because then I think they kind of lose all their teeth, and I think they're actually more interesting as an antagonist, an anti-Federation of sorts, that made up of a wide number of different aliens. But here, I don't know.
But not only that, once you have Odo's influence, like, what use is, like, the Jem Hadar and the Vorta? Like, does Odo still want to be affiliated with these groups?
Probably not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it feels like his influence would be like, let's stop drugging these people and, programming them to believe we're gods.
Yeah.
You wonder if just the fundamental idea of the Dominion just crumbles with the Odo joining the Great Link.
So do you think there's the opportunity now for the Federation to get its way and say, hey, no, we do want to explore the Gamma Quadrant. We do want to engage in trade relations. Do you think that the wormhole is actually kind of... I never really thought that the wormhole conceit lived up to the potential that DS9 introduced in that first episode. It was literally closed off for two whole seasons.
Yeah.
And then before that, they might go have an adventure in the Gamma Quadrant here or there, but the show worked best when it was focused on what was going on in the station,
Definitely.
So I feel very mixed about this, but I think this is kind of the opportunity to kind of reintroduce how significant the wormhole and what a game changer it could be for this isolated, remote planet known as Bajor.
I agree 100%. It's interesting, Ira Steven Behr said, like, one of his greatest gifts he felt he gave Star Trek, when he could walk away from it all, was the Dominion. But I really question whether they are going to play any sort of role in the future of Star Trek. I feel like they're so difficult to use because of all the mythology of Deep Space Nine.
I think you're right. Like, with Odo's influence, like, would we really see more Jem Hadar and more Vorta? Like, I think that would ring false to me.
Yeah.
So will we see more changelings? I could see that, but what are they really going to do that's interesting? I wonder if there's going to be just nothing more than, say, a name drop similar to what we got in, say, Star Trek Nemesis.
You know?
Or like, oh yeah, Dominion War. Remember that guy?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I just have a hard time imagining the Georgiou spinoff, the Picard spinoff, whatever, what future Star Trek shows we get, Lower Decks, really bringing in Dominion stories. It just seems like something so far outside of the reach of these shows.
I can guarantee the Georgia spinoff won't be doing Dominion stories.
But you know what I mean? Like, it just feels like it's this hugely fascinating and wonderfully told element of Star Trek canon that I feel like is maybe the hardest of any of the other, you know, alien, whatever you want to call them, elements of these shows to bring back.
Well, let's look at the next closest parallel, which would maybe be the Zindi. I think it'd actually be quite fortuitous to bring the Zindi back. I think there's actually a lot more story there to tell with regards to maybe how they become allies.
Especially after a long time gap, too.
Yeah. Isn't it established, doesn't Daniels essentially say that the Zindi eventually joined the Federation?
I can't remember.
I know for a that they are allied, and I think maybe the Zindi eventually joins the Federation at a certain point. But look, it's worth exploring, you know?
I feel like the Zindi are much easier to reintroduce and kind of just explain in a couple sentences.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like the Dominion's so much more complicated.
Well, it's kind of that whole Sela dilemma. Like, do you have to, like, I don't know, explain Sela every single time she returns on screen? And I think that's why they kind of kept her off Deep Space Nine, when I think there's actually some cool opportunities they could have done. But it's just like, wait, casual viewers are like, why is Denise Crosby wearing, like, ears?
Yeah. I just wonder if the concept of the Dominion, you just could never do anymore, but you might introduce a changeling or a Vorta somewhere along the road.
Yeah.
I just wonder if the very idea of the Dominion is done.
I think it might be,
yeah.
But we got a good run out of it, so definitely. I can't really complain.
No, for sure. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. So, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we are going to be discussing our captains as mentors. They're always been kind of mentor characters, and I think it's interesting we can look at the mentor-mentee relationships that have been developed and have a lot of fun exploring where the captains have done right and maybe where they've messed up a little bit here or there.
I look forward to half an hour on Jellico.
Yeah, I cannot wait until we can really explore what Lorca gave to his crew.
Yeah. And before we just sign off, I want to just give a plug to the Cool Canadian History Podcast, which has just put up two episodes recently on the Star Trek life of William Shatner and Jimmy Doohan, co-written by myself, and as well as Dave Boris, who hosts the podcast. He's been on this show many a times. And
also talk to us about the Dominion.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, yeah. We did. We found some fun ways to work in some Star Trek terms you may not hear in your typical A&E, you know, biography of William Shatner story. So check those out at coolcanadianhistory.com or just on your iTunes, et cetera, et cetera.
This is like Umox. Did you sneak that in?
I wish.
Okay.
I didn't think of that one. Yeah. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Viruses for Everyone on the George O spinoff, Smith.
Oh, why, thank you. You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T. T as in Treachery, Faith in the Great River, O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.